It's Thursday the 21st of November here in the Northern Hemisphere, and it's time for Season 12, Episode 33 of the Ubuntu Podcast. The nights are closing in, it's definitely getting cold, winter is coming. Tonight we're going to go over your community news and events and some of the news headlines, and joining me this week is Alan.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm very well. It's just you and I this evening, right?
Yes, yes, indeed. Just you and me, but I'm sure we'll manage.
Yeah, and for good reason. So Mark, our regular co-presenter, him and his partner are a family.
Mm.
So they've got a baby girl, and mother and baby are doing well, is what we can report there for everyone that's following Mark's LTS release announcements. What have you been up to since last time?
So I've been to Barcelona.
Oh, lovely. I like Barcelona. What have you been doing there?
Linux Application Summit, which was a conference. I think this is the third one. It's the first one I've been to. And it was held in a community civic center, very interesting building. And previous incarnations of this were quite GNOME centric. It was organized as part of the GNOME project by people in the GNOME project. But this is the first one where they've combined forces with the KDE people, and people from elementary were there as well. And we were there, and other people, Red Hat people were there, people from Purism, people from the Pine Phone were there. It was
hang on a minute. Just slow down a minute. So GNOME and KDE were there, Canonical and Red Hat were there, and Pine and Purism were there. Wow, this is like cats and dogs living together.
Yes, all in the same building.
Now I know what the answer is going to be. There was no fights and no disagreements, right?
Yep, no punch-ups. There was plenty of frank, open discussion, shall we say. But it was a conference. You know, there were talks and discussions, and there were birds of a feather sessions and workshops. So, yeah, it was a traditional open sourcey style conference. And the focus was mostly on answering the question of how do we get more people creating apps for Linux. So there were talks from people who were talking about some of the technologies that are available in Linux, and some people suggesting technologies people should use and advantages of one technology over another. So yeah, it was a pretty full schedule for 4 days.
Wow. Okay. Were there any common themes that emerged?
There were a few talks about packaging, unfortunately.
But of course.
We talked a little bit about snaps, and the Flatpak guys were there. And there were plenty of other talks. There were talks about diversity, and one of the keynote was from Frank Karliczek at Nextcloud, his talk was quite entertaining, and it was talking about how we suck in Linux and his suggestions on how we could improve things, how we could make the Linux app ecosystem better, and it was quite interesting, quite frank, being frank, and addressed, you know, the GNOME developers and the KDE developers, and tried to suggest, you know, it would be great if we worked together, which, you know, is the goal of that whole conference.
Mm.
So yeah, it was good. It was really good. And hopefully they're going to do another one next year, but I think the one next year might be in the US. So the first two were in the US. This one was in Barcelona.
So they're going to continent hop to draw in people from different geographies.
Yes, exactly.
Wise. Wow. Yes, sadly, I wasn't there. I had to miss that one. It's certainly an event I'd love to go to, though. Maybe next year. And now it's time for some community news. I found an interesting article on the Ubuntu blog this week that was written by Francisco from the web team at Canonical, and he was explaining how they've reduced their Docker images sizes by 60%.
Huh. I didn't know they used Docker I personally don't use Docker at all. So this is all news to me whenever I hear about people did a thing with Docker. I mean, I probably have a Docker image somewhere, but I don't actively use it.
No, it wasn't clear to me if they were using Docker or they're just using, you know, Docker files as a mechanism to create the container images. But apparently the web team deploy all of the content facing web infrastructure at Canonical using Docker files. So the article explains like the relationship of depends packages, recommends and suggest packages in Debs and what those mean and how they avoided installing the recommended packages in order to achieve these space savings. But this also resulted in a 15% acceleration in the time it took to compose the images as well.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, so it's a win-win.
I did see some people when this blog post went out were like, oh, duh, yeah. Like, you know, you put less into a Docker image, it's going to be faster. It's nice to see it like written up so that people, you know how to actually do it.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, somebody that's using Ubuntu in this way, they've obviously found an easy win optimization, and the Ubuntu blog is widely read, and there are still people out there who are, you know, getting acquainted with container technologies like Docker, and this is probably useful information to, you know, an emerging group of people who are coming into this fresh.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to see that shared. So they do warn that, you know, if you do create your Docker images with no recommended packages, then you may find that there's stuff missing in your image that you've usually taken for granted, but you can stage that for yourself. If you're using Docker and you want a cheap way to make it smaller, then there's a link in the show notes.
Mm-hmm. Next up, Jonathan Riddell has blogged briefly about his time at the Linux Application Summit 2019. And the reason I put this in there is because he's got a few photos and it saves me having to blog about it. it's a bit brief, but there's a couple of things to note. I mean, he highlighted the fact that there are GNOME people and KDE people on stage at the same time. And there was a nice social event on the first evening at the venue. And we had a few beers and it was lovely to just, you know, catch up and introduce a few people. Like I introduced Jonathan to the elementary team who were there. So Cassidy and Daniel Foray and Karen were there, and Jonathan's never met them because their paths don't intersect, because Jonathan always works on KDE stuff and the elementary guys are working on their stuff, and they're quite aligned with GNOME. So it was a really nice atmosphere to get people talking about lots of kind of different things. Neil McGovern was there from the GNOME side, from the GNOME Board Foundation, and he gave a good talk about the fact that the GNOME project is being chased down by these patent troll, which we've talked about in previous episodes, but it was nice hearing it straight from him, the whole process and how he found out about it, and via text message when he was out of service or something, I think. It was nice to see other people from different sides blogging about LAS.
It's interesting what you said there about, you know, you being able to introduce Jonathan, who works on KDE, to the elementary guys. Because, you know, elementary will go to Guadec, for example, and KDE have their own academy event. You know, they don't. And we find ourselves in a rather interesting position because we're rather privileged that we get to work with all of these people quite regularly. So we are in this nice position where we do know a lot of people and we are able to introduce people and make these connections. And it's probably a lot more fun doing that in person than how we usually do it, which is, you know, via email and IRC.
And it also shows how friendly all these people are. Like, we keep seeing, you know, people on the internet throwing jabs at the other side, in inverted commas, which is, you know, whoever it is that don't use the thing that I use are the others. And I had dinner with someone from OpenSUSE, someone from Endless, some people from Canonical, KDE people, you know, a real cross-section of the Linux desktop application ecosystem. It was lovely. And they're all lovely people, of course. So, yeah, really good. And I hope there's another one next year.
Yeah, it can't be stressed enough that, I mean, we see this day in, day out. Again, we're privileged to see it, that the developers on all these different projects all get along with one another. They've all got common goals. They're all smart people. They're all nice people. And they just want to see us, everyone, succeed and be successful. It's a shame that it gets so skewed by people outside of those circles who are trying to create, you know, stories and friction that just isn't there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Anyway, there's some good news.
There is good news. So the Ubuntu Focal Fossa 2004 daily images are now available. So we obviously announced the code name, well, I think hours after 1910 was released, even minutes after 1910 was released. Pretty sure I was still in the London office when that happened. And since then, we've been working on a lot of the transitions that happen between the releases. So things like uplifting the Python version. There's a whole bunch of packages that have to get rebuilt and what have you. And then we open the floodgates from Debian, because we've had a freeze whilst we don't, you know, accept new packages from Debian. And then we fix up all of the tests and everything. And once that happens, then new ISOs appear. So now you can download your Focal Fossa 2004 daily ISO, and you could install it today and then ride the rolling wave of updates to April 23rd, 2020.
And it's, to be clear, it's not just the GNOME desktop packages that are updated. It's like the whole archive. So if you go and search for the Focal Changes mailing list. I find these fascinating, these mailing lists. Every release, there's a new mailing list created, and you can see every package that gets pushed to the archive. There's an email that goes to that list. Nobody subscribes to that. Oh, I'm sure some people do, crazy people. Well, I just browse it on the web. And if you scroll through, you can see like 1,000 packages by Rick Mills, you know, mostly KDE packages, because he works on Kubuntu. And so you're not limited to just the Ubuntu 2004 Focal image. You could grab a Kubuntu one or the Lubuntu one, because they'll all have new stuff in them, and, you know, new GCC and all the low level stuff that's shared, but also all the new desktop-y stuff and whatever else they depend on. It's fantastic.
It was interesting. I was talking to some guys from the desktop team last week, and they were explaining that there's quite a close relationship in the packages that Ubuntu Budgie uses compared to Ubuntu. And with the uplift in GNOME and its associated technologies, it can happen that the packages for Budgie get stuck in a failed state for the testing. And that holds back all of the packages that Ubuntu needs. So the desktop team quite often dive in and fix a load of stuff in Ubuntu Budgie in order to clear the backlog of stuff that, you know, we need to get into the distribution to build, you know, the desktop.
But this is the point of Ubuntu, really. Like, this is why we have multiple flavors built from the same archive, you know, why it's not some rando third-party PPA or an additional overlay that's stuck on top. If you're all working on the same archive, then you can all pitch in and work on that commons of packages.
I think it's really quite nice that, you know, the flavors are allowed to express themselves. We've all got a different opinion on how the desktop should be presented, you know, what the desktop should be for Linux users. But despite that sort of disagreement on how the desktop should be presented, we're all working in concert to, you know, create the, as you say, the commons of packages that make up all of Ubuntu. And obviously, you know, the kernel team and the foundations team and the security team and the server and cloud team are all working on those same packages. It's pretty fantastic, really, when you see all of these people harmonizing and pulling in the same direction.
Hallelujah, brother.
What else did you find this week?
Grumpy developer Richard Hughes has written a blog post about Google Chrome OS and the Linux firmware update tool that he maintains. So those of you who use Linux are probably maybe aware of this thing called firmware update tool. You might not, but it's a project that Richard started and he still maintains. And it's a mechanism that allows hardware manufacturers to deliver firmware updates to Linux users. So in the horrible past, you might buy a laptop and find that the only way to get new firmware on it, like a BIOS update or firmware for controller chips within the computer, would be to install Windows and then download some funky BIOS update tool. Whereas Richard's project, FWAPD, affectionately called, allows you to do that on Linux. And it's even integrated into GNOME software. So there's you might see firmware updates for not just laptops, but other external devices as well, like 8-bit do controllers and all kinds of other stuff like mice and keyboards.
That, I think, is like the next level capability, because it's all well and good updating your BIOS. And it is great because, like you say, it was either Windows or you download that 2.88 megabyte free DOS image and try and shoehorn some crufty MS-DOS updater in there. But being able to update peripherals like Logitech Universal Receiver devices and 8-bit Do controllers and what have you, it's getting pretty cool now.
Anyway, the point of this blog post that he's written recently is to highlight that he's heard that Chrome OS devices, so Chromebooks, which have a certification scheme, a certification sticker, that now incorporates the firmware update tool that he's developed. So if you're a hardware manufacturer and you want to make a certified Chromebook, you have to integrate the firmware update tool as the system that will update the firmware on the device, which is fascinating. I'd not realized that. I mean, everyone knows Chrome OS is technically Linux under the hood, and it uses lots of common components with the standard full-fat Linux desktop, but that's quite neat. And the reason I mentioned Grumpy Developer is he says that himself. Like, here are some ways in his blog post where you can prevent me being grumpy by doing these things. And he highlights, you know, ways and means that you as an ODM or an OEM, the way you can interact with him, the upstream developer and maintainer of the firmware update tool and the service.
The LVFS project is really taking on a life of its own now. It's becoming like a critical component in the Linux ecosystem in much the same way that the kernel and systemd are. I wonder if Rich is going to be in a position where he can, you know, dedicate his time to this, because it's really pivotal now.
Mm. One thing that I did find a bit interesting is this blog post smacks of documentation. You know, this stuff that's in there, you know, you have to send it to me in this format and here are some tips with how you write things. That all feels like documentation that should be part of the project. Maybe it's written in a blog post because then it gets the word out that, you know, it's Chrome OS and this is super good news, and it is very good news. But that kind of stuff should probably be in documentation somewhere, I imagine.
Maybe there's a subtle call to action there for somebody interested in the project to help by curating the documentation or improving it in some fashion.
Mm.
In related news to LVFS, I hear that there are two other UIs coming so that you'll be able to update your firmware on things other than GNOME in the very, very near future.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. You got one last story here. What's this about?
Yeah, I snuck this extra one in there. It's about an open ebook reader that I discovered. I can't remember where I stumbled upon this.
Hardware?
Yeah, hardware device. So it's called the Open Book, and it's all on GitHub. All the CAD files and all the bill of materials and all the details about how you can build your own ebook reader. It uses an e-ink display, and it's got, you know, all the necessary support chips and controllers and all the other bits and bobs that go inside it, and the design of the circuit board that you could have manufactured. Now, it's not finished. It's not a complete project. I think they said it's something like 90% of the way there on the board alone, but there's still software that's just not there yet, that's not been developed yet. But I found this super fascinating because I hadn't thought about the fact that there aren't any open ebook readers. They're all tied to some company or platform, and this would be a great way to liberate your books and also build an interesting device. It's early days, but I think it looks really cool.
Oh, interesting. I've never invested in an ebook reader.
I have one because when I travel, I don't like carrying big fat books, and I never know which book I'm going to be in the mood for reading. And an ebook reader, you can chuck all your books on it and pick and choose what you want to read. So I have a Kindle, but and I've had others. I've had a Nook before, but the Kindle's the one I really enjoy using.
Yeah, I've just used a tablet and the apps. I've never invested in an actual reader. Anyway, that's all for the community news. And now we've got some news headlines from around the tech world. And I'm delighted to see that Pine64 have announced the limited availability of the PinePhone.
Ooh.
I know. I'm very excited for this project, I have to say.
When I was at LAS, a guy came over to the Ubuntu stand and was talking to me and said, how's it going? And I said, yeah, great. I said, hey, do you want a t-shirt? And I gave him a t-shirt. And he said, oh, I must give you something. And he gave me a bit of merchandise from...
Thought you were going to say gave you a Pine phone.
I wish. He gave me a bit of merchandise from Pine, and he introduced himself, and he's the founder of Pine.
Oh, wow. Holy cow.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, I have to ask you some questions. So, yes, he told me that the developer boards were being manufactured Wednesday last week, which was like the day after I met him. So absolutely lovely chap. He's got big plans for all of this stuff. It's really great. But anyway, as you were saying.
They are shipping the pre-release Pine phones. They should have all have been shipped as we're recording the show. They should have gone out on November the 15th. And they're looking at fulfilling their pre-orders. And then hopefully by December, January time, everything will be delivered to those people that have made orders. And most excitingly, mass production will begin after the Chinese New Year, around early March 2020.
Yeah, so I hear there are going to be some developers of operating systems which run on these devices who may well be at FOSDEM. So that might be an interesting event to go to if you're interested in catching a glimpse of these devices running actual software and get your filthy mittens on them.
Or, you know, find the likes of Postmarket OS and UB ports and follow along with how their developments are going. As I understand it, that there have been some hardware delays, which have been attributed to sort of supply chain fails. But Pine were able to put those delays to good use and have used that unexpected extra time to fix a whole bunch of antenna-related stuff. So they're saying that, you know, what they're shipping to developers should be quite well-rounded and problem-free platforms for developers to build their OS releases on top of.
Nice. And it's not really aimed at end users. It won't have a operating system pre-installed. You'll have to hunt down an OS, like you said, one of the ones you listed.
So mass production in March 2020, that's when it's time for end users. Right now, this is all developer-focused activity. But nonetheless, exciting.
In bad news, it's bad and good in a way. Nextcloud have become a target of ransomware that encrypts files and, potentially asks the user for money via some cryptocurrency. And this was discovered by a Nextcloud user who discovered some of their files were being encrypted and then synchronized across the network to all the other devices, which, you know, is a downside of having a synchronization system. Like, as soon as you bust the file in one place, it synchronizes that breakage everywhere. And that was a bit of a problem for the user. The Payload was a Python script compiled as a Linux ELF binary using this Pi installer thing to try and hide it. And none of the virus engines would have found it anyway. So that was a bit of a problem. And there was a ransom note in there, so you could tell it was definitely, you know, something that was targeting these users and wanting them to pay to decrypt the documents or whatever files it was that it was encrypting. And it detailed in the ransom note how the thing was encrypted and what type of key was used in order to encrypt it, I guess, to, you know, give it some credibility. And they demanded 0.025 Bitcoin, which at the current, like right now, is about $200 or thereabouts, but that number will change.
So that's an interesting amount, because that feels affordable for people that have Bitcoin or could buy Bitcoin to that that effect. But there's something like 300,000 Nextcloud deployments.
Right.
So if you do the sums, that's...
Yeah. I mean, we don't know yet how widely this has spread. And I haven't seen many reports of people saying, oh, my data's been encrypted. But you never know, because sometimes people are scared about talking about these things and might just pay up. You never know. But Nextcloud have done an investigation and they've put out a blog post that suggests people should update, because it looks like the attacker got in through a vulnerability in PHP FPM. But this announcement went out in October, 24th of October. So if you've updated since then, you should be good.
Well, not Bitcoin, but fiat currencies, private internet access has been acquired for $95.5 million.
Good Lord.
In fact, a bit more than that when you take into account share transactions.
Wow.
Yeah, so PIA have been acquired, or at least CAPE Technologies have expressed their interest in acquiring PIA for $95.5 million. It's about $120 million and change when you take into account movements of shares between organizations.
So they have about a million customers. PIA apparently have about a million customers. What's that, 90 quid per customer?
Yeah, I suppose. And I don't know what I've never been a PIA customer, so I see them advertising everywhere and supporting lots of open source projects. And is that a concern now they've been acquired? Does that potentially mean that they may be pulling out of the sponsorship they've been doing for some of these projects?
Well, I don't think technically PIA actually sponsored things, because PIA were owned by London Trust Media, who were also the owners of Linux Journal. And they were in, as I understand it, some financial difficulty. And I believe it was effectively London Trust Media who were doing the sponsorship in the name of PIA, in the same way that Canonical sponsor events in the name of Ubuntu, that kind of thing, right? And I think the sale of PIA has gone to help stem those losses from LTM to pay off some of those debts. And, I mean, from what I understand it, this has more than paid off their debts. So they now have some cash in the bank, which should see them able to, I don't know, potentially continue sponsoring things. But they wouldn't do it in the name of PIA, because they don't own PIA anymore. I don't know what else LTM owns.
No.
And I don't recall seeing any products that I've thought, oh, that's an LTM product sponsoring a podcast. So I suspect PIA may not sponsor things, and I suspect LTM may stop sponsoring things, but I don't know what else LTM do. I think they do some kind of crypto nonsense stuff.
But of course,
yes.
Well, it's interesting. So, if the deal goes through, which is expected to be finished next year, then CAPE will be acquiring the private internet access name and operating their various VPN providers that they've bought recently under that one banner.
And I can see how some people get a bit agitated, because PIA was seen as good guys, and they, didn't log, so the people felt confident using them. I have a free PIA subscription that I got for a couple of years when I gave a talk at a PIA sponsored event. So I actually have the client, but I've only ever used it twice. A VPN is not a thing I use on a daily basis. But those people who do use it value the fact that they claim not to log, and arguably they've had it proven that they don't log. I don't know how you can continue to prove that. I don't know, but I know some people value that quite highly. So it could well be that people go looking for a different VPN provider if Cape Technologies, the new owners, don't keep up that assertion.
I wouldn't jump ship just yet, because I'm pretty sure that, you know, not logging is like a staple feature of all serious VPN providers these days.
Indeed. What's up next?
Well, good news. Our friends at Slimbook in Spain have announced a new high-end Linux laptop.
And it is high-end as well, isn't it? It's quite a monster.
It is. So this is called the Slimbook Pro X 15, and it's a 15-inch Linux laptop from Slimbook. And it has the 6-core Intel i7-9750H processor and an NVIDIA GTX 1650 Max-Q GPU, and supports up to 32 gigs of RAM.
That's a nice machine. You could use that for all kinds of things.
It's a proper workstation in my book, yeah. And it also has a 2K 15.6-inch display with thin bezels, so they claim, and it supports the full 100% sRGB color gamut.
Mm. Backlit, keyboard, twin cameras, all the usual ports.
Yeah, all the good stuff.
But how much is it?
It's about 1,200 euros, so that's about £1 million now.
That's about £2.50, depending upon whether you're listening to this before or after Brexit.
I'm covering our bases there.
This is exciting stuff. That Slimbook were making, you know, pretty common or garden laptops, but they've actually branched out into something that's a bit of a differentiator here, because I don't know many other Linux laptop vendors who have something beefy like that. I know some of them do have relatively high-end machines, but this is quite a spiffy spec, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly Entroware have big laptop devices like this, you know, that are full with CPUs and RAM and GPUs. But I think this is interesting because we're seeing this more and more now that you know, the tier one vendors that ship Ubuntu on their laptops, and the likes of Entroware and Slimbook and System 76, all have real high-end workstation devices, and it seems to be a niche that Ubuntu is fitting very well these days, and everyone's looking to capitalize on what is clearly a growing audience for devices like this.
And it fits a whole bunch of use cases, whether you're doing, like, you're developing machine learning applications, or you want to have super scale containers with your cloud deployment that you want to do on your laptop first and then deploy to your hybrid cloud or whatever it is. I'm sure those words mean something to somebody. I'm not entirely sure I got them in the right order, but I think so. But yeah, and also having a decent GPU, if you're going to be doing any kind of video encoding and stuff like that, you can offload that workload to the GPU. So yeah, it's a nice machine. It would be nice to get one for review, but unfortunately, as we're at the end of the season, I don't think we're going to get that. It won't be a lot of point getting that and then giving it back and doing an episode next year if we come back.
I don't know. Marcus Castalis listens to this podcast. He can translate for our friends at Slimbook to organise a review unit, I'm sure.
Well, maybe the Ubuntu Portugal podcast people should get one.
Oh, that's a good idea.
They're nearer by, the postage would be cheaper as well.
True.
And finally, in shock news, Valve have announced Half-Life Alyx, which is a game.
Okay.
It comes out next year, March 2020.
Uh-huh.
And it's in the Half-Life storyline, but it's a VR game.
Now, is this the game that people have been waiting for? Have Valve finally figured out how to count to three, or have they deliberately called this not three to dodge counting to three?
I think, it's a story centered around a character. So I think it seems fair to call it Half-Life Alyx, and maybe it's a nod to all those people who tell everyone Valve can't count to three. Maybe it's a nod to that. But I think the more interesting thing is the fact that it's VR.
Yes.
And they have put out a little trailer, and there are little nuggets in there that I absolutely love. So in traditional video games where you have ammunition that's been dropped or placed somewhere, you generally walk near it and then press a button on a keyboard, and that magically puts it into a bag or rucksack that you're holding, and you press a different key on the keyboard to magically put that ammunition into the gun that is in your hand that's controlled by a mouse, right? That's not real, right? Whereas if you watch the trailer, there's a part where she's in a building and she's being attacked from all sides, and she's scrabbling around looking for ammo and puts her hands out in front of her, which obviously the player would be doing with their hands.
Actual holding, hands.
Yeah, and parts some things on a shelf and finds behind those things there's some ammunition, and then pops the gun open and slides that ammunition into the gun like you would do in real life. And I think that's the compelling immersive part of VR that is would take these kind of first person games to the next level, is that whole, you actually have the tactile grabbing hold of a thing, putting two things together, you know, putting a clip in a gun or putting an ammo in a gun, or, you know, holding onto a thing on the wall in order to get more health or repair something while you're fending people off and shooting. But actually your hand is being kept held in place in order to, you know, cling onto the wall or whatever it might be. So I think it looks really exciting.
So I watched the trailer, if that's what it's called. It's interesting that you have picked out exactly the same thing that I thought. Huh, well, that is interesting. There's an actual game mechanic there which is reflecting real life, because, you know, if you panic, you're going to struggle to get those shotgun rounds into the gun in time to fend off the, you know, the alien or zombie or whatever they were, I wasn't quite sure, that, you know, are bearing down upon you. I'm rather outspoken that, you know, I don't think that VR is or will be successful. But from what I've seen of this game trailer, this is by far the most compelling example of a VR game I've seen, because it actually plays to the strengths of VR, as you've explained. So I will be very interested to see how this does, although I won't actually be able to try it out for myself, because unfortunately it's going to be a Windows-only Steam VR release. At least that's what's been announced so far.
Yes, they do support multiple headsets. So you can use the Valve Index, Vive, Oculus, and Windows MR devices. And interestingly, if you've already got a Valve Index, you get the game for free. It will just appear in your Steam collection. Even if you only bought the controllers and not the full headset, you get the game. So there is an incentive there for them to sell Valve Indexes between now and March.
I wonder if this is going to be a platform shifter. Back in the late 1990s, the Matrix DVD basically bootstrapped the DVD player industry. I wonder if this game could be the thing that catapults VR into more widespread adoption.
We'll just have to wait and see, won't we?
We will. And that's all for our news.
We know you've got a Facebook account, so stop sharing cat photos for a moment and like or share our posts so your friends and family can find the Ubuntu podcast.
Well, that's all for episode 33. With just the two of us, we did wonder whether we would actually be able to put together a sensible length show, but this looks like the longest episode of the season so far.
Whoopsies.
So... Quick, Mark, come back and save this. anyway, we'll see you next week when we'll be discussing your feedback about distro hoppers. And if you want to get in touch, email show@ubuntupodcast.org or join us on Twitter @ubuntupodcast.